Madame Tallois. Okay. Very interesting subject. I've dealt with this subject for many years, asking a lot of people what they think about it. I actually, the past week, have sat down piles and piles and piles of books trying to understand what the meaning of this time of year is. I think we'll start first of all with the meaning of the word Trois. So Yom just means day of whatever it would be. Mm-hmm. Trois. Now, traditionally, when you ask an average Jew in the street, a religious Jew, asking what the word Trois means to them, they immediately think of the description of the man standing in the middle of the synagogue with the ram's horn. Usually we use a ram's horn in most Jewish places. This is affected by a historical thing. The Mishnah speaks about two different types of horns that you can be used. Mm-hmm. The only horn you can't use is a horn of a cow, of a calf. They do what we call an exegesis, that they describe that the calf would remind God of the golden calf, so you can't use the horn of a cow or of an ox or anything of the sort. So we usually use the horns of the ram or the antelope. If you go to the Yemenite synagogues, I've seen it. I live in Jerusalem, so I see this all over the place. A lot of people come to visit Israel, messianics of sorts, and also Jews that come to visit the land of Israel, and they go excited by these gigantic shofarot. Shofarot is a plural, shofar is a singular form, shofarot. The ot ending is a feminine ending.
Yes.
It's feminine suffix, plural feminine suffix. I've heard the occasional person says call it shofarim, and it makes me giggle a bit. It's shofarot.
Okay.
And you can buy them everywhere. Are they all high quality? Just as a strong suggestion to everyone out there, don't buy anything without testing it out.
Okay? Right, because it's an instrument, right? It is an instrument, and obviously some will play better than others.
Nehemiah has several big ones at home. He even has a black one, which he bought. I don't remember if he bought it or from Nehemiah Golden. I can't remember if he bought it or received it as a gift, but it's from Africa.
Oh, true.
And I actually also found a video. Yesterday I found a video, 2 days ago I found a video on YouTube of a African person blowing a shofar, but they had the hole in, not in the end, literally at the tip, but they actually made a hole in the center of it. Like,
really?
I would say center to the end of it, but they made a hole. It's just like a flute or something. And it made a noise, a pretty good one as well. But I think if you make a sound from the tip, it's more powerful. Because you're going straight through the opening instead of going from the side. It has a slightly different effect.
Sure.
So when you use a shofar, you can make more of a blast sound.
And you would know, you would know about this, because I just want to remind the listeners that you're a pretty keen didgeridoo player as well. I mean, obviously, I don't doubt that you – I mean, I haven't heard you blow a shofar, but I don't doubt that you would give it a pretty good whirl. And of course, we featured you the first time you were on the program. You played some didgeridoo for us, which was a wonderful thing. But I've never seen a shofar being played from the middle or being played in a flute-like position. That'd be fascinating. But I've only seen these. I've seen the ram horns. Obviously, they can be from the ram. They can be from a goat as well, right? From a goat buck.
Yeah, but they're very small. I mean, again, I live in Jerusalem, so we see all these strange things that people are selling. You can, here in Israel, on average, you can buy the ram, the antelope, mm-hmm. and you can buy these really cheap ones made from goat. They're not strong enough. It's too short to even create an element of sound.
Sure.
Now, by the way, you should know that the way the shofar is processed, actually what they do, if anyone's ever butchered an animal here, I mean, I've dealt with killing animals for eating. I'm actually against killing animals for sports. You know, just if anyone goes to Africa and they want to shoot something, just don't. It's no point.
Sure.
but what you have is you have the horn itself, and there's a filling inside that sometimes goes all the way through. Now, if you're lucky and you pull it off, the whole thing comes off and just have that little thing dangling mm-hmm. from the animal's head. But sometimes you pull it off and there's something inside. So first of all, you take a metal rod, a hot metal rod, and you put it through and you scrape everything out. Mm. Now, the next thing you have to do to clean out, because if you see these things are squiggly and they have funny shapes, you actually have to boil them.
To boil it, yeah.
And you stretch it out, and then you can clean it out, make a straight hole to make the mouthpiece, and then you let it fold back. What's very important about, now I'm going to clarify something. When people say Yemenite shofarot, what they mean is what people think Yemenite shofarot are. But it depends which area from Yemen they're from. If you're dealing with people, for example, from the area of Sana'a, which is the capital of Yemen, most of the Jews of Sana'a were followers of the decrees of Maimonides. And Maimonides held of an opinion that said you can't use the boiling method to stretch the shofar. And also he held that you have to have only a ram's horn. And that goes back to what I mentioned about the Mishnah. The Mishnah tractate of Rosh Hashanah, the other name for Yom Teruah traditionally used by Orthodox Jews, also conservative reform use the same name, is Rosh Hashanah. Rosh is head. Hashanah, the year, the head of the year, the beginning of the year.
Sure.
By the way, just as an interesting link, the names of the months we use today in the regular Hebrew calendar is Elul, Cheshvan, whatever names you want to pick. You do a very simple search, even on Wikipedia, it gives you the origins of these names, and the origins of the names are Babylonian names. What's very interesting, what I discovered is that Tishrei, which is the seventh month of the biblical calendar, Tishrei is the same as the word Tashritu. Okay, that's the original name. And Akkadian, Tashritu, meant the head of the year.
Truly.
That's as far as I know. This is what I found in my encyclopedias and everything. But again, you always find someone arguing that's not correct. But that's what I discovered the past couple of weeks, rereading bits and pieces that I already compiled throughout the years. So Tashritu has to do with the concept of the beginning of the year. And we'll touch about that in a moment.
Yes.
Usually if you speak of a real, what we usually Yemenites would identify as a real Yemenite shofar, we're actually talking about ram horns. The antelope is more of other areas, maybe villagers that didn't have access to ram's horns, or they didn't butcher these animals, so they hunted antelopes and everything. But the Mishnah speaks of shofarot from ayal, which is the Hebrew word for ram, or shofarot from a ya'el, which is basically a wild animal, something like a gazelle or something, but it probably means the antelope, and the antelope is native to this area, or was native to this area.
Sure.
So either one, but traditionally, if you go to any regular synagogue in the Jewish world, usually they use a ram's horn, because that's what was considered to be the correct one to use for Rosh Hashanah. I suggest if anyone has time, they can pick up the tractate of Rosh Hashanah in English and read through, I think it's chapter 3, if I remember correctly. And it mentions that on the Jubilee you use one type of horn, on Rosh Hashanah you use a different type of horn.
Because there's also references to a silver trumpet in the Tanakh as well. Does that come into play here?
The description in the Mishnah is that Yom Teruah was celebrated in the temple itself by blowing the shofar together with two silver trumpets. Now, silver trumpets are mentioned in the Book of Numbers regarding the issue of traveling. The camp had to move from place to place. But it also says on the silver trumpets to blow them at the appointed times, on the day of rejoicing, on the new moon day, over the sacrifices. And they also did the exact same thing when it came to the shofar. The only difference was that the shofar would carry on the sound beyond the trumpets, meaning you hear the trumpets. Hot trumpets would stop at one point, and the shofar will carry on the sound a bit more. So that's just, they used to do that on the gates, and this travels into the issue that part of the idea in the mindset of that time, probably even the mindset of the first temple period, was that Yom Teruah is also a day where, I'm trying to think exactly how to describe this, but basically the main event of Yom Teruah is actually to be done in the temple to such an extent that even if Yom Teruah happens to be on a Shabbat, now traditionally in rabbinical Judaism, if it happens to be on Shabbat, we don't blow the shofar because of the issue of carrying the shofar out in the public. It's a bit complex. I'm not going to go into it. I don't think anyone's really interested to know all this stuff. But basically, we don't blow the shofar on a Shabbat. But in the temple, they will always blow the shofar, no matter what.
Well, taking that information so far, can we go to one of the passages? Because there's really only two passages in which it is mentioned And
so we have Leviticus 23, and we also have in the Book of Numbers a mentioning. Now, I want to actually ignore the one in the Book of Numbers, because what I think what's going on in the Book of Numbers there is that each segment there, which has to do with the sacrifice, it's a very, very strange thing. You would think that in the Book of Leviticus, which has to do with all temple service, you have the description of the sacrifices. But no, it's not there. The description is in the Book of Numbers. But what I think goes on there in the Book of Numbers, this is an introduction. Each set of sacrifices has one verse describing what is it connected to. So the Book of Numbers is slightly irrelevant. I mean, it's not completely irrelevant. It's just what's important here more is what appears in the Book of Leviticus, because it uses a very specific format for describing Yom Teruah. Mm-hmm. In the Book of Numbers, it just says Yom Teruah. It's a day of the word Teruah. In the Book of Leviticus, it calls it Zichron Teruah. And the word Zichron Teruah is very, very important for the understanding of what Yom Teruah is.
Okay. Well, let me read it in the English first, if you like, because we're really only dealing with two verses, right? We're dealing with verse 24 and 25 of chapter 23 of Leviticus, which says, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, in the 7th month, on the first day of the month, you shall have a Sabbath, a memorial of blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation." Verse 25, "Shall do no servile work therein, but you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord."
So first of all, I want to clarify something. The Hebrew doesn't say trumpets. Mm-hmm. The reason you have the word trumpets there in your translation has to do with the Septuagint. The Septuagint actually adds the word trumpets. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't, the word there is not trumpets. It's something very interesting. Philo does the exact same thing. It uses the word for musical instrument that you make a sound, a blasting sound from. And the word used in the Septuagint can mean shofar, or ram's horn, mm-hmm. or trumpets. You can't trust that translation 100%, because the Hebrew says, I'm going to read first in Hebrew, it says, "Daber el b'nei Yisrael lemor, b'chodesh ha-shaviri, ב-1 לחודש, יהיה לכם שבתון, זיכרון תרועה, מקרא קודש." So rather, the word for trumpet is chatzotzra. Mm-hmm. The word does not appear. So you translated already this, but what we're looking at here is the word zichron tru'ah. Now, the word zecher is can mean two things in the Tanakh. It can mean a memory or a mentioning. Something you do with your lips. For example, right. We have the verse in the Book of Exodus when God reveals his name to Moses. He says to him, "Ze shmi le'olam, veze zichri le'dor dor." Okay? It means, this is my name forever, and this is my mentioning for all generations. Now, yes. One of the things that happens a lot, first of all, this is slightly poetic language, which means we also have a system of parallels here. So, ze shmi le'olam. So the word ze, this, appears twice. Shmi and zichri, shmi, my name, zichri, my mentioning. The e ending is makes it possessive from the word shili, my. Mm-hmm. So shmi and zichri are parallels. They mean the exact same thing. So you see that the word zichri not necessarily means memory, like zecher Amalek, the memory of Amalek blot out the memory of Amalek, but Zecher also has to do with the name of something being carried on the lips. So when you remember something, you also usually use the speech. And this the speech, is
so you're vocalizing.
You vocalize exactly the mentioning or the memory of something is sometimes in many cases passed down through a vocalization of it.
Sure.
So one of the interesting things about the word zichron teruah, it might be that the word teruah, now we're going to deal with the word teruah itself, it might be that the word teruah has nothing to do with a musical instrument. Now everyone's going to go, either going to go into complete shock and saying, well, what do you mean? But we know it's a shofar. And some people who actually know what the Karaite opinion is are going to go, yeah, we know that. Now, what is exactly the Karaite opinion? The Karaites usually call, when they translate the word yom teruah, they translate a day of shouting. Anyone who's ever gone into Nehemiah Golden's website can see that. Anyone who's ever read Karaite books knows this. And I've never actually sat down with Karaites that I know to see exactly what's traditionally done in the synagogues.
Mm-hmm.
But basically what they're describing is this is a day of praising. You're praising God. Now, going back to the word Teruah. The word Torah, all over the Bible, appears in two forms. It would appear, well, not forms, it appears as one word, but it would appear either as vocalizing something or making sound with an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's very, very interesting, we can actually go over many, many verses. If anyone ever does a search on the word Torah, I am going to pull out just a few verses just to try to...
To illustrate the point. Because if I'm to understand you correctly, it's possible that it may be saying that Yom Teruah is a day for mentioning something with a shout of the voice, with a vocalization of the voice to proclaim even. Can I use the word proclaim?
Proclaim something. And now we're going to also lead into what traditionally is understood to be Yom Teruah. I just want to bring an example. This is a slightly negative example, but when Moses came down from the mountain of the Ten Commandments, what happens? It says here that Joshua heard something. It says in Hebrew, "Vayishma Yehoshua et kol ha'am bere'o, vayomer el Moshe kol b'minchama b'machane." So the translation is, and when Joshua or Yehoshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said unto Moses, "There is a noise of war in the camp." Bere'o is the exact same root as Torah.
Okay.
So, and there's numerous examples of this. There are many, many examples. For example, if we take the Psalm 47, which is a psalm I personally think represents what the issue of Yom Teruah is, it says here, for example, verse 2, Kol ha'amim tik'u chaf, hari'u le'elohim bekol rina. The word hari'u is also Teruah, and it says bekol rina. So the translation is, all nations, clap your hands, shout unto God with the voice of a triumph.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Rina is not really triumph. I'm just reading from a translation. Rina is more of a celebration voice.
Sure.
Then we have in the same psalm, it says, Ala Elohim bitru'ah, Adonai bekol shofar. And this is a verse, by the way, recited just before we start blowing the shofar. It says, God is gone up amidst shouting. The Lord, or basically the translation is the Lord, amidst the sound of a horn. So this verse, by the way, was used in the rabbinical world to explain what do you do the sound with the shofar? Or how do you make the sound? You make the sound with the shofar.
Can I've just got this in front of me, and of course this is Psalm 47, and you've just read out verse 1 and verse 5. Do you mind if I just give this to the listeners?
Because 2 and 6, actually.
It's, yes, 2 and 6 in the correct Bible. In my English Bible, what it says is, O clap your hands, all you peoples, shout to God with the voice of triumph, for the Lord Most High is awesome. He is a great king over all the earth. He will subdue the people under us and the nations under our feet. He will choose our inheritance for us, the excellence of Jacob, whom he loves. Selah. God has gone up with a shout, the Lord with the sound of a trumpet. Sing praises to God, sing praises to our King, sing praises, for God is the King of all the earth. Sing praises with understanding. God reigns over the nations. God sits on his holy throne. The princes of the peoples have gathered together, the people of the God of Abraham. For the shields of the earth belong to God. He is greatly exalted. Boy, that's a great chapter, isn't it?
It's a great chapter, and actually, I personally think that this represents the meaning of Yom Teruah. Traditionally, how the way we're explaining Judaism is that Yom Teruah is a day where we proclaim in the world that the God of Israel is the God of the world, and He's our King.
Amen.
And it actually is expressed in the daily prayer that we use now. When I say prayers, usually we have two sets of prayers on the holy days and on the Sabbath. We have the regular prayer. We usually call it the main Sheva. That's during the Sabbath. We have seven blessings. We don't do the regular Amidah, if anyone knows what it is. It's 18 or 19, depending how you look at it. But it's basically 19 blessings that we recite every day in every daily prayer. Then on the Sabbath we have seven, we shorten it down, but we also add what we call the musaf, the extra prayer. But on Rosh Hashanah, it's actually a bit different. In Rosh Hashanah, we have the prayer, the Rosh Hashanah prayer, which has additional verses to it, additional pieces. And then we have the Musaf, and the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah is very, very special. First of all, it becomes nine blessings mm-hmm. and very long ones. And they're built on the issue of Zichronot, Zmichoyot, Zichronot, and Shofarot. Malchoyot is to do with God being king. Zichronot is from the issue of remembering things. And Shofarot are verses that have to do with the sound of the shofar. I want to focus specifically on the issue of Malchuyot. What we do in Malchuyot is we proclaim God to be king. Now, each blessing has to have 10 verses, and each verse deals with God being king over the world. And this is how we actually express that. So what's very, very interesting that in the rabbinical tradition, we're actually doing the basic understanding of rabbinical world, which is using the shofar, because what we do is immediately after we read the Torah, we blow the shofar, we make 30 sounds.
30?
Which is basically 30 sounds. We have these different sets. Every rumble sound, every tro'ah or shvarim, comes with a short, one sound, like a doo, mm-hmm. basically. If anyone goes into YouTube, we should have in the end of this recording a segment of this,
yes.
What it sounds like. Now, there's a lot of details that I'm going to go into, but very, very quickly, there's a thing called Shvarim and a thing called Torah. And there were different debates exactly what is the Torah of the Torah. So we have Shvarim, which is like the 3-2-2-2, and then we have the what we usually call Torah, which is like the really short sounds of tu-tu-tu-tu-tu-tu. And they all come with a simple sound before and after.
Mm-hmm.
And the dilemma was, is it the three pieces, the 2-2-2, or is it the 2-2-2-2-2? Sounds a bit funny, but when you describe it like that.
But the listeners will get an idea of what you're talking about. At the end of this interview, we're going to go out with some of the sounds of the shofar, some of these sounds that Yoel is talking about. So hang tight and you'll get to hear them in the end.
And that's one discussion. Then there's a debate, is it actually the three sounds with the nine sounds together? We usually do nine sounds more or less. And also the other thing that exists is that there's a very, very old tradition. This is the tradition you're going to be hearing in the recording in the end of the talk, is actually a rumbling sound. It's not like like everyone knows, everyone's used to, but it's actually a wavy sound, very, very short waves. And this is the tradition of many of the European Jews. This is a tradition of Yemenite Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And if the Yemenites and the European Jews have something in common, it means that there's a good chance that this is a tradition used at the time, maybe I would dare say, of the Second Temple, because European Jews, many, many, many of the European Jews are descendants of Jews who actually lived in the land of Israel mm-hmm. and were exiled to Rome. Many of the European Jews are originally from Italy and Spain. And there were many Jews who left the land of Israel and ended up in France and England.
Sure.
So this might be, and it's only speculation, this might be the original tradition of the Jews of the land of Israel. And slightly changed, but there's no real difference in between the sound we used to and this sound.
Mm-hmm.
But what's very, very interesting is that besides doing what traditionally is understood in the rabbinical world, we even do what the Karaites say. We actually do the praising and the proclaiming of God being king of the world. We do the other form of Torah, which is, I would say, we're basically covering ourselves from all ends by doing that.
Sure.
But what it might also hint is that there was, in the ancient world, in the ancient Israelite world, an understanding that both of them are correct. And what the rabbis did, they combined both of them as one.
Okay. So now, well, it brings me to the question, because it's possibly the set-apart day that has the least information given to us, I do believe. And again, all we have is, speak to the children of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, you shall have a Sabbath rest, a memorial blowing trumpets, a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it, and you shall offer an offering made by fire to Yehovah. Now, now a couple of things. First of all, let me ask you, why do you reckon it's on the first day of the seventh month that it becomes a Shabbat? Why do you think? Really, the question is why?
So why? Well, first of all, there's two things we have to look at. There's a lot of details here, but there's two things we have to look at. First of all, the concept of the idea of Rosh Hashanah.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, Rosh Hashanah, as I mentioned already, is the other name we used for Yom Tov, actually the name used by everyone for Yom Tov.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is in the Bible, Yom Tov is not the beginning of the year. Yom Tov is really the seventh month.
Mm-hmm.
So one very short analogy to this is that there's an influence from the Babylonian calendar. They had a celebration called the Akitu. Actually, from what I know, originated from the Sumerians, and they celebrated it on the month of Tashritu, seventh month as the beginning of the year. The Babylonians developed it that they celebrated twice a year and two halves of the year, that represent beginnings and ends of things.
Mm-hmm.
One on the first day of spring, the first day of Nisanu,
mm-hmm.
The month of the Aviv.
Yes.
And also the traditional one they picked up from the Sumerians or Shumarians, depends how you read it, where you started the beginning of autumn. And there's a good chance, I'm not saying it's 100%, there's a good chance that Jews, when they came back from Babylon, picked that up and said, okay, this is the beginning of the year. The other possibility is that this has to do with the calendar, the civilian calendar. That the civilian calendar in the ancient world was based on this time, the time of Tishrei, being the beginning of the year. And it's only for official things. I mean, you look at the Mishnah, it actually does describe that. It's really more for official things, less for holidays and things that have to do with the Torah. The first month of the year is still Nisan,
mm-hmm.
and this is more of a technical issue. Another thing I saw was that it might have been affected by the Greek calendar, that the house of Seleucus, which was the northern Greek king, who, by the way, they were the ones that were involved in the Hasmonean War with the story of Hanukkah,
mm-hmm.
that they had their own calendar that started off on Tishrei. And there is a possibility that that's what affected the Jewish calendar. Because from around that time, there were many, many changes in the Jewish world, and that's where we see the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the Essenes and the other different groups we have, and then arguments over the calendar. Is it a solar calendar? Is it a lunar calendar? Is it a lunar solar calendar? So that there's a chance that that's where it started, and that's how the whole mess with the calendar started.
So we're talking about the traditions of Yom Teruah and how it is observed today, perhaps. But what I'm curious about, though, what I'm getting to is why would our God say, why has He set this particular day as a Shabbat?
So I would say that the seventh month, first of all, has a lot of festivals in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's Yom Kippur.
Mm-hmm.
The Atonement, and then the Sukkot. Sukkot also is probably considered to be the biggest festival.
Mm-hmm.
Because it says in the book of Deuteronomy to be extra happy. It says, Vayita ach sameach, you rejoice a lot during Sukkot. So Sukkot is like the grand finale of something.
Sure.
So one of the ideas, two ideas of that, one idea I came up with, the other one a student of mine told
me.
One of the ideas is that the Yom Teruah is as if this grand opening for the grand finale. So what we're doing is we're standing there on the first day of this month and saying, okay, let's make a ton of noise, celebrating the beginning of this month,
mm-hmm.
being the opening of the grand finale.
Sure, okay. Setting the beginning of the month apart by making this grand noise, big, it's obvious, it's loud, and here we are in the seventh month, and it's the Shabbat, and it's like here we've arrived. It's a very important month. There's lots of days. There's Yom Kippur. There's Sukkot, and so on and so forth. Right.
And that's now you just hit another point. This is what my student said to me: is that the seventh month is like a Shabbat. So we're announcing the beginning of this Shabbat. And what they used to do in the Second Temple period, they actually had when Shabbat came in, when it started, they had someone who would stand on this balcony, this porch. Mm-hmm. in a temple mount blowing a trumpet, telling everyone it's about to begin.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically Yom Tov is almost like a day of announcing. We're announcing the beginning of this seventh month. Yes. Meaning that the seventh month is very, very, very important.
Very important, yeah. And
Sukkot, you see, for example, the book of Zechariah, one celebration, one festival is put out. You know, it's emphasized is Sukkot. If all the nations won't come to Jerusalem, we'll be punished.
Yeah.
So Sukkot, there's something very, very grand about Sukkot, something very, very important about Sukkot.
Indeed.
So if we do a show about Sukkot, we can speak about that.
Wonderful. Okay, so let me ask you now, just moving away from Yom Teruah, let's go back to Rosh Hashanah.
Okay, so as everyone knows, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Teruah, starts off on the first day of the moon. For everyone to know when the new moon is sighted is a bit complex, in this every village has someone sighting it.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was at one point, specifically with the diaspora, basically what happened was because of the diaspora, it was very difficult for people to know exactly when the new moon would be sighted. As everyone should know this, a month could be 29 or 30 days, and that can be the big difference. So we see the moon on the first day of the sixth month of Elul, and we wait 29 days. There's a chance that in the end of the 29th day, we're going to see a new moon. There's a chance we won't see it. So what happened was that they started keeping 2 days. They said, we don't know exactly when it's going to be. We're going to keep 2 days.
Okay.
Hoping that by the time we have to get to Yom Kippur, we'll know exactly which day is the correct day.
Uh-huh.
Now, one of the interesting things about the rabbinical calendar is that the first day of Rosh Hashanah, of Yom Teruah, you never see a moon. You never actually see a moon. So usually really Yom Teruah, in many cases, would be the next day.
It is, as I mentioned before, it is the day that probably has the least detail dedicated to it in the Tanakh. And so I appreciate you, my friend, coming on and talking about Yom Teruah to possibly shed a little bit more light, a little bit more detail on what it means in the Hebrew and what we're to do on that day. So how are you going to be spending it?
I'm going to be spending it as a day of festival, a festive day. We're going to go to the synagogue.
Yes.
We're going to do the special prayers.
And it's going to be,
I'm going to take all my family to the synagogue to hear the shofar.
To hear the shofar, the 30 sounds that we're going to hear at the end of this discussion.
Yeah, well, yes, you're going to hear 30 sounds in this, but we do more than 30 sounds. There's actually, because we, that was one thing I forgot to mention. What we also do is the prayers are then recited again by the leader of the congregation, and we incorporate the sounds of the shofar into the prayers themselves.
Truly.
Yeah. So that's what you cool. have, you have, you read a segment, and then the leader stops, and then there's another man who blows the shofar, and he makes 30 sounds, uh-huh. and then we carry on, and it happens like 3 times.
Oh.
And what happens is that at the end of the prayer, we add another 10 sounds.
Yeah, so we get up to 100. So we got 100 shofar.
Over 100 shofar sounds.
Yeah.
And then you have, you know, the place I live in, so we have everyone's tries to do all the different sounds that exist. This is part of the Jewish mentality, trying to cover as much as we can.
Yes.
So you have cases where in the end of prayers, several people will stay in the synagogue and one guy will try to imitate all the different sounds that are possible, because you have, besides the issue of the rumbling sound versus the little toots, you also have a simple sound with like a twist in the end or a twist in the beginning. It just becomes completely messy. So I usually tell everyone meets me, it doesn't matter if there's a twist or if it's a rumble, just go and do it.
So do you have it? Does it last throughout? Let me just ask you this question by way of closing. Is it kind of the shofar blasting, does it last throughout the entirety of the day? Do people feel obligated to, I don't know, every half hour get out there and throw a few more shofar blasts out into the open?
You do have that occasionally. I mean, you'll sit in your house and every like half an hour, you hear a shofar blast from somewhere else.
Okay.
In many cases, Yom Teruah is also a day for children. Children just decide, oh, we can make a ton of noise with these things. It's completely acceptable.
Yeah.
So you'll see children running around with a shofar in their hand, blowing it wherever they can.
Even so it's a day when they're allowed to make some loud noise.
Exactly.
Beautiful.
The other thing that we do have, there are people who take their shofar and go out to the street, and they'll stop bypassers, non-religious bypassers, and say, do you want to hear the sound of the shofar? And you'll be surprised how many people say yes. Because during this time of year, the high holidays, specifically Yom Kippur, mm-hmm. most people here in Israel keep Yom Kippur. We're talking that over 80%, 87, I think it's like 87% of Jews in the land of Israel fast on Yom Kippur.
Truly.
A very high number of people attend the synagogues because essentially this is like the period of time where people remember that they're Jewish. Mm-hmm. When the festivals come, most people say, okay, wait, by the way, I'm Jewish, and I'm very proud of being Jewish, and people will celebrate the festivals as much as they can. And the numbers they do surveys every year, and they discovered the numbers are going up all the time.
Is that right? That's fascinating.
Yep.
That's really interesting, especially considering the latest statistics in regards to religious Jews in the land of Israel and secular Jews and how people have classified themselves. But obviously, when it comes to Yom Kippur, there's a higher degree of loyalty, I suppose, and observance. I'm looking forward to talking about Yom Kippur with you. And of course, that is the 10th day of the 7th month. So hopefully in just over a week, we're going to be able to do that. Will you come back on the program? We can discuss it then.
I'll try.
The email address is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. That's HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. Thank you, my friend, for coming back onto Truth to You and sharing with us about Yom Teruah.
You're welcome, and I just want to tell everyone, may you have a meaningful and a wonderful Yom Teruah, no matter where you celebrate or how you celebrate it. And as I already mentioned in the past, the whole purpose of me going on this show is to try to help as much as I can, donating information regarding the Jewish world, regarding the Torah and the Jewish perspective, and helping as much as I can to help each other understand the will of God.
And as you often say, the object is to follow the Torah, yeah?
The object is to follow the Torah.
Amen, amen. So for the listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word, and here we go out with some of the sounds of the shofar. Shalom.